This is Circulating Ideas, episode 100. I'm Steve Thomas. My guest for this very special episode is the American Library Association's Executive Director, Keith Michael Fields. Keith, welcome to the show.
A great pleasure to be joining you.
I wanted to start out, you are now the executive director of the American Library Association and have been for quite a while now. So what led you to librarianship in the first place?
Well, wow, that's a great story. Thank you. No one has ever asked me that. I owe it all, first of all, to my mother, and that is that we had a little sort of home library and used to read together, and I got interested in reading through her. The breakthrough on this was rather odd, though. My grandfather was an ambulance driver for the Veterans Administration Hospital in Buffalo, New York, and he, one summer, was given the assignment of picking up people's libraries, and when they had were donating them to the Veterans Administration. So he would pick them up, and he would go, and the librarians there would pick out the books that they wanted to or wanted to use for patients at the hospital. And then they would send him off to dump these books in the landfill. And he stopped at the house at least three times and let me take as many books off of the ambulance as I could. So next thing you knew, I had a library of about 2,000 books. My father built me some bookshelves under the basement stairs, and the rest is history. I had an insatiable appetite. I read all sorts of bizarre things. The libraries contained everything from Shakespeare to the How and Why Club, the old Book of Knowledge from the 20s. So I would say that my love of reading and, I was one of the few kids in the neighborhood that had their own home library. I subsequently got involved in the local public library and started using that. I think by the time I was in college, I was at least potentially interested in librarianship. I did graduate ultimately with a degree in philosophy, and I always tell the story that I had absolutely no prospect whatsoever of ever earning a living as a philosophy major, but I was philosophical about it. And I will tell you that I was crossing campus one day, and this was the very, very late 1960s, and a guy named Wild Bill Rosenberg, who looked like he just came off of a wagon train with a fringed buckskin jacket and, shoulder-length hair, said, and I quote him, "There's money in library science, dude." So I rushed over to the library school and actually was able to receive a National Defense Fellowship, and that's how I got into library school. I started out as a school librarian. I've worked in a public library. I won't go through all of the details, but that's the long of it.
And how did Wild Bill's prediction work out? Are you now a bajillionaire, too, because there's money in libraries?
Well, I think he meant that they had scholarships.
Right.
But, I'm not a bazillionaire. I want that to be a clear. I do think, I always say that it was a National Defense Fellowship, and I do feel that I have contributed materially to our nation's security by helping to make libraries better. I'm very, very comfortable with having earned that scholarship.
Well, when you were in library school, I mean, we won't go through step by step with your employment or anything, but what were your... I don't know that anybody, when they're in the library school, says, I'm going to be the executive director of the ALA when I get... that's my ultimate plan. What was your... what was kind of your professional plans as you were in library school? Were you thinking school libraries, public libraries? You wanted to be a director? Like, what were you thinking as like your 10-year plan, 20-year plan, stuff like that?
Well, I'll probably get in trouble for this. I originally always envisioned a sort of a... let's say a D.H. Lawrence kind of librarian, you know, with a pipe and a tweed jacket with leather patches on the elbows. I certainly was interested in academic librarianship and potentially archival work. I ultimately went to an ALA conference, and I did get an offer from a university library, but at the same time, I ran into a group of people from a public library in Michigan City, Indiana, that I would contend was one of the most progressive libraries in the United States at that point. And that's one of those, and there are a few points, I think, in everyone's career where it was just the road not taken. The people intrigued me. It was just an absolutely great run. As I said, you talk about things like community engagement, electronic resources, bringing technology, running local history projects, doing public programming. We really did it all. It was just a great experience. I think that kind of really was a turning point for me. As far as the career goes, I, you know, have been, as I said, a school librarian, a public librarian. I then went back for a year of postgraduate, then got hired by E.J. Josey at the New York State Library. Mm-hmm. And for those of your listeners who are following, E.J. really was the leader in integrating the American Library Association back in the early and mid-60s. I did work there with community-based planning, went to the New Jersey State Library, became a system director, and then ultimately the director of the Massachusetts Board of Library Commissioners, which is the state agency in Massachusetts that is responsible for all state and federal programs for libraries there. It was when I was in Michigan City that I got a job as a photo editor for an ALA publication, and got to come to ALA once a week for a couple of months researching photographs to illustrate a publication in the ALA files, and got to meet Bob Wedgeworth. And I would have to say that ALA was such an interesting place. The people were wonderful. That did stick with me. I've been an active member of ALA for a long time now. Probably been to 80 straight conferences or 90 straight conferences. At a certain point when the opportunity came to serve as the executive director, I have so much respect for ALA, and I know what it did for my career, and just really want to do anything I can to both. I see us as serving the profession, which certainly affected me directly, serving libraries, which I think has helped to build stronger libraries in this country, and then the public. Things like our positions on intellectual freedom, privacy, and copyright, and access to public information, I think really make a difference in people's lives on a daily basis, and that gives me enormous pleasure.
Well, I think one of the questions that people have had about your position, not you specifically, but just the position, is, can you talk kind of vaguely about what it is exactly that you do and how you work kind of with the ALA presidents? I mean, I know it helps to have somebody there that's kind of there because the presidents are 1 year at a time. You're kind of the continuity, I think, between those and work with their strengths. And how would you describe your job to somebody who didn't have any idea what it was?
I think you're focusing in at where the rubber kind of hits the road. We work and try and engage as many members as we can involve in developing a strategic plan for the association, and that gives us a broad framework. So, for instance, at this point, information policy, advocacy, and professional leadership development are three areas of focus. focus. And the programs, individual programs, support that. Each president comes in with their particular strengths and interests, and I see it as a matter of aligning interests and resources. The president is a very powerful force, a positive force. For instance, last year, Sari Feldman, as president, very much interested in public awareness, and the library's transform campaign really was, she was the driving force behind it. The fact is that it matched very closely with our strategic plan priority, which was a public awareness campaign. So part of it is trying to work with the president to kind of match up and find ways in which we can take individual interests and strengths align them so that we're really doing as much as we can to advance the goals that we've set for ourselves. As an association. Working with a new president every year is certainly, it's an interesting, probably not for everyone. We do work together for a year as president-elect, and then as past president, they continue to serve on the executive board. A lot of it is, how do we take what's been a good idea that's advanced us and help to make it something that becomes a permanent part of the association? So I have not seen, I know that at some points in the past, this whole issue of, well, individual initiatives versus overall goals. I think that's worked pretty smoothly. Certainly, that's been my experience.
Well, it seems like a lot of times their individual initiatives kind of feed into each other and work to either toward the strategic plan or just toward goals in general, because I was going back and reading some stuff up on stuff that you've written and some other stuff that ALA has been writing, and transformation has been sort of a goal and been talked about for, it was, I think, 6-7 years back. I was seeing things being written about that, so it's kind of the Library's Transform campaign was like maybe a summit of that, but it's not like it just came out of nowhere and Sari was just like, oh, I want to do this, and so we just changed completely direction and did that. It's just it fit in a great way that matched the goals already.
Absolutely, I couldn't state it better.
So as the Library's Transform campaign, I believe from my perspective, seems to be pretty successful. How do you all within ALA feel that it's going?
Well, I would say it's going very, very well. There's a couple of, just to sort of go over the goal of the campaign, this is where the because statements and working with Little Jacket, which is the creative firm that we've been working with on this, the goal is to create, I'll call them sort of content packages, you can call a because statement that are maybe a little challenging, maybe a little offbeat, maybe a little bit out of the ordinary. We see this enormous potential with social media for getting new messages out. So I think the primary driving force on this is some of our social media platforms. We have 85,000 followers on Facebook. We're looking for people to tweet and retweet some of these messages. So part of what we've been doing is to try and craft each week, we throw another because statement or another factoid out to see if we can go viral. We had one very large hit this year where we had about 4 million people ended up seeing a sign that a library in Michigan had put out in front of the library, and it basically said, because not everything on the internet is true. So part of it is to really use the packaging, which is, I think, very smart and very thoughtful, to try and get us out into new spaces where a traditional library message wouldn't exist. And I think by being a little bit out of the ordinary, by being a little bit challenging, by maybe getting people's curiosity up, we do then have a website, which has been getting a lot of traffic, which then provides people with maybe some background on the because statement, because most of them are really based on something that is transforming within libraries, or something that libraries do that's transformative to the lives of individuals or communities. So the goal here is to provide people with an avenue through the Because statements and through our social media work to kind of invite people in to places like I Love My Library, which is our website for the public, and to the library's Transform website. So the other half of this then are the local libraries. And we were, I think, very pleasantly surprised when the first time we sent out some information on this in the fall, we didn't get a giant pickup. But when we sent some messages out related to National Library Week, we ended up with about 3,000 libraries and library supporters becoming part of the campaign, meaning they were using the graphics, they were using the Because statements, they were tweeting and sharing on Facebook. Messages in their local communities. So I would say the pickup for year one has been really great, and we're working on a really strong year two on this. Julie Todaro is taking the focus in the direction of the expert in the library, which is a little bit of a focus this year on the role that librarians play in this whole transformational effort. So we've got some new Because statements that focus on librarians as the best search engine in the library, the goal being to get the message out into new audiences and to give local libraries something that they can use then in local campaigns and local public awareness efforts in libraries of all types.
Yeah, and I appreciate that the expert in the library thing kind of fits in with the larger Libraries Transform campaign, because it kind of does fight against that, what you talked about a little bit, of some of the people think that, oh, a president comes in and they just completely do something different. No, this is another, I guess, transformation of the campaign. I mean, it's another step in that. So it's,
yeah. And Julie Todaro has been great. She's very thoughtful, and she's a community college librarian from a gigantic community college, 41,000 students. And I'm going to get this wrong, like a dozen campuses in Austin, Texas. So she is very, very experienced in working with diverse communities, and she's just been great in helping take the campaign forward in the second year.
That's great. So as I think we all agree, all librarians all agree that libraries have to transform to keep moving into the 21st century. We can't just be what we were. We have to kind of keep up with the times. But I always kind of struggle with the idea of, like, what's something that's core to librarianship that we don't ever want to lose? Like, how can you see a library 50 years ago and a library today and a library in 50 years from now and still be able to point to it and say that's a library? Like, we don't want to become just a community center, but we obviously want to take on some of that. Do you have any ideas on that, of how what you think is, like, core to librarianship itself, that as we transform and become a lot different, that we don't lose that core?
Yeah, I think that this is really a good point. And it's one of the ones where I certainly have some strong opinions on this. And that is, for instance, we're actively pursuing e-books and electronic resources. At the same time, as the publishing industry can tell you, e-books had a fabulous period of growth, but we seem to have entered into a period now where people read e-books and regular books. E-book sales have kind of leveled off as an overall percentage. So I think there are some signs that printed materials are probably not, if you followed the initial timeline or the trajectory for e-books, people were saying that we would no longer have print books after 10 years. Well, I think that has proven not to be true. So I think your understanding of the fact that we need to balance these things. So let me talk then about some of the things. I think that the work we do with children, for instance, is something that we tend to, we're very modest about. But I think if the truth be known, we are the primary institutions in our communities that are supporting our early childhood literacy. If you really think of, and the You know, there's especially the Benton Society or Benton Foundation study. Parents understand that taking their child to the library is synonymous with being a good parent. So I think that the role that libraries play in helping children to develop an early love of reading is really critical. I think that the role that libraries play, and especially school libraries, but libraries of all types, in taking students and helping them to become independent readers and independent learners is huge in its impact on our society. I do think that the role that libraries play at this point, we provide essentially access to e-government. As more and more services are available online, as fewer and fewer services are available either face-to-face or in a printed form, you are seeing that libraries increasingly are the places where people are coming to interact with government. You know, the most dramatic example of that, I think, is after Hurricane Katrina, when you could only get FEMA assistance by filling out an online form, and you had people that had been driven out of their houses, that every library within several hundred mile radius of New Orleans had people standing in line, and librarians were helping them to then access essential services. So I think those are just some examples. I do think that, you know, the role of browsing, the role of reader's advisory is something that's changing in its form. But in the final analysis, a lot of libraries are now doing online reader's advisory for community groups and whatever. I think these are things that libraries maybe did in person at one point, and at this point now we're increasingly doing through social media and through interactions out in community groups. I think other things such as service to the elderly, service to the handicapped, service to new immigrants, these are things that are very, I think, very, very central to our value. And I don't see them changing very quickly. You know, I have sometimes done programs on the future of libraries, and I do point out that for the foreseeable future, we are predicting that people will still have bodies. And as a result, they will need to put them somewhere. And I think everybody being down in their parents' basement with their handheld device is so that the whole notion of libraries as places where people come to be with people of all ages, to learn, pursue their intellectual curiosity, is still a very powerful thing. And let me say that I don't believe it will change. I sometimes say that we have to be a good association today, tomorrow, next week, next year. I also think we need to have a strong association 100 years from now, because I believe that there will be libraries, because communities created libraries, and they're sustained by, I think, community aspirations and community needs. I think it's a great invention with a long, long life ahead of it.
How do you see the association itself transforming to meet the needs of 21st century libraries?
Well, obviously, the biggest opportunity has to do with online engagement. And, you know, let's say a conference, you may have, even if you have 20,000 people attending the conference, that still is maybe a quarter or a third of the ALA membership. And I think that people who are able to come to an ALA conference or a midwinter meeting or a PLA or ACRL or AASL meeting or an ALSC Institute are certainly going to benefit from that. I think we're really trying to look at ways in which we can extend that engagement. We have people whose preferred method of interaction may be through social media or through working together in virtual groups. And there's a lot of experimentation going around at this point. Not everyone wants to be engaged in the same fashion. I think the other thing we want to have is to make sure that people have good options, that they're receiving ongoing information from us, so that it helps them to do their jobs better. I think the networking is kind of a key factor in that it's difficult. I do think the interactions with other professionals, with what's going on in other libraries, really helps you to be a better librarian, even if you stay in the same job your whole life. You need creativity and new ideas coming in order to, you know, to be the best you can.
You talked earlier about working with to integrate libraries back in the 60s, and I wanted to ask you now that that's still, diversity is still an issue in the profession, I think. I think we've done a lot of things to try to improve that. Do you have ideas of how the ALA can continue to do that, to try to improve diversity? Because we're still, I think, at the last surveys I saw, we're still pretty overwhelmingly white, pretty overwhelmingly female. How do you kind of get outside that and bring more people into the profession?
Yeah, I think that, you know, Spectrum has really had an impact. If you look at it, we're pushing 1,000 graduates for the life of the program. If there are, in fact, let's say the figure we're using is about 120, 150,000 professionals working in libraries, we're approaching 1%, which is not bad. I do believe, based on what I'm seeing in library schools, that in fact the profession is changing. I'm certainly seeing a much more diverse student body, so I am optimistic. I do think that we need to be, it can't just be ALA. We need the library schools and we need employers to work with us. I know a number of libraries have, many people have homegrown talent that doesn't necessarily have the credentials, and I think many of the most successful libraries have created programs that allow people who may have community roots, who have are really outstanding within the library. And I think those libraries that have found ways to help them to pursue credentials so that they can advance in their careers have really had an impact. So I do believe that the associations working with the library schools and with employers, which is to say libraries, it's going to need the three of those groups working together and continuing pressure on this. I do think that the pace of change is now accelerating, but it certainly has been, I think, frustrating at how slowly it's been in the past.
Right. So school libraries are another group that's kind of in trouble now. How can the ALA help support them and make them seem to see it, to be seen as more essential to their administration? Because obviously within the profession, we see what's important about school libraries, but it seems like a lot of the bills that come out of Congress have cut out school libraries from the specific funding. And how do we make them be seen as essential more often? And what can we do?
Right. There is actually some really good news, and that is that just this past year, with the reauthorization of the Elementary and Secondary Act, ESSA, for the first time since that libraries were disappeared when No Child Left Behind was passed about a decade ago, school libraries are at least back on the map. Now, the law provides some support for school library services, particularly for urban districts, but it also provides for what's called an effective school library program. And as a result, ASL, working with the Office for Advocacy and the Washington office, at this point has undertaken a national program, because what we now need to do is to go out to the individual states, and we'll be there at chapter conferences, we'll be there at standalone planning workshops, because library supporters in each of the states now need to work with the State Department of Education and with local communities to actually then promote specifically what is now, at least for the first time in, as I say, more than a decade, part of the definition of a quality education. So it's one of these deals where we've managed to now create, and this really took a lot of work of librarians of all types, we've created a framework nationally that now supports efforts at the statewide and local level. We've got a lot of work ahead of us because states are beginning to develop plans. We're going to need to offer training. We're going to need to help support the chapters and the chapter affiliates. We need to bring in members of the public on this at both the national and particularly now the statewide level. It is now going to have to be fought one state at a time, but I think that we have the best opportunity that we've had in many, many years.
That's great to hear. So that we do have National Library Legislative Day. Do you feel like that kind of thing helps connect librarians with those on Capitol Hill?
Oh, I certainly do. People are like, well, you know, it's just one day and you have one meeting and whatever. Anyone who's ever been to our nation's capital knows that it is literally overflowing with people that are trying to promote their goals and seek support from Congress for what they're trying to do. I think it's very important that, you know, 500 or, you know, 600 people show up and have an opportunity to keep Congress aware of the fact that, you know, we know where they live. We have stories to tell, very convincing stories about how libraries are helping people. I think the LSTA program in particular is a very, very good program in that the states really do make sure that those funds work at the statewide level, which is where the majority of the impact occurs. E-rate is huge. It's probably, somewhere in the neighborhood of $200 million in support for libraries to obtain technology. So I do think that it's important. We always say it's great. Can you meet in the district? And better still, can you get the congressman or the senator into a library? There's plenty of opportunities to show them the wonderful things that people are doing at the local level. And that's clearly where, the basic relationship building occurs. And the more they understand about how libraries impact people's lives, this is such a small amount of money. I mean, it's a rounding error in the defense budget. It is. I was in Massachusetts, and the big dig was $11 billion a year. And we managed to get an appropriation. We ultimately got about $250 million for public library construction. We were able to rebuild most of the 350 public libraries in Massachusetts. At this point, I think they've probably even begun to work on, those were main libraries, they've begun to work on branches. But I think at one point I calculated that what they were spending on library construction, an 11-minute delay in the big dig would build another library. So I think it illustrates that we are very, very, a very, very good investment of public funds. And I think that certainly in Massachusetts, we had very strong Republican support and very strong Democratic support. Once in a while, they even competed with each other to see who could do more for libraries. And I think that that's very heartening that people understand. They make very, very big decisions that involve a lot of money. I think, again, libraries are a very, very small and a very, very, very important investment.
Well, and I think people dismiss too easily that face-to-face and that conversation that you have, because I know there have been things that I've written to my local congressperson about, and they actually do respond back, and that's just an email to them. So, I mean, if people actually talk to them, I mean, they will give you some kind of response. I mean, I didn't actually talk to the congressman themselves, but somebody from their office would write me back and say, oh, we'd like to hear more about what you hear about this issue or whatever. So a lot of them, I mean, it is important to actually just engage with them.
Right. And, a lot of what they deal with are complaints, right. Obviously, as we all do. But I think that this is where we have there's so many heartening and really compelling stories about how libraries are affecting people's lives. And that's where the local library people, local trustees and friends can do such a good job by really helping people who have access to or can make resources available understand how good the work is that those resources do.
Well, I know one of the things that I'd written to my congressman was about getting Carla Hayden confirmed. And I wonder if did that make – I assume the atmosphere at ALA was very – good when she was nominated finally. That
absolutely delighted. Yes,
former ALA president and just obviously a friend of librarians and a librarian herself. And I know one thing I know a lot of people said was that, oh, she's an actual librarian, but I feel like that's skewing a little bit because you don't necessarily need the MLIS to be Librarian of Congress, but you need to understand librarians. And I'm not going to bad talk the previous Librarian of Congress, but I know that Carla, Dr. Hayden, I shouldn't be that informal with her, Dr. Hayden will do a great job of that. I mean, she understands librarianship, so.
The other thing I think that she's, Library of Congress always has a sort of an identity crisis in that they're this tremendous storehouse of information. The question always becomes, how do they serve the people of this country? And I think one of her perspectives I think that will really be critical is just an unerring interest in making those resources accessible. So I think that her basic orientation toward how do we make sure that the work we're doing is meeting the needs of people, is serving communities all over this country. I think a Library of Congress that's willing to play a little bit more of a leadership role in the library world is something that could really, really serve us well, because they're a great illustration of many of the sort of transformative trends that are occurring. They are sort of the flagship for libraries, and I think somebody who gets libraries has an opportunity to really position them in a position that could really, really be very, very strong in helping to further the work we're trying to do.
Yeah, I mean, because people who went to library school, we all, of course, know that technically it's not the National Library, but everybody, most civilians think it's the National Library. So it is the Library of the United States, according to most, probably 95% of people you would ask in the United States. But
yeah,
she's our figurehead sort of now. So I did want to ask about you talked about the advocacy portion of the strategic plan. What can you give a progress report on sort of the rest of the strategic plan, like on information policy and leadership development?
Yeah, great. Okay, thank you for asking. In the advocacy portion, the first of our strategies is the National Public Awareness Campaign, advocacy training, and building a broader network of advocates. Advocates are really the next two objectives or strategies. This year, you're going to see a much stronger push from ALA to provide advocacy training. We have a thing called Advocacy Boot Camp, which is launching this fall in a couple of states, and that will be to help kind of train the next generation of advocates. And OIF, Office of Intellectual Freedom, and the Office for Library Advocacy are going to work together. And what it will help to do is talk about how to advocate for support for libraries, how to advocate for intellectual freedom, and really share how to do it experiences that will help people to more effectively advocate. And this word we expect to see, we'd like to offer this in all of the states. I also talked about the asset training, so that's another really a major push that AASL is going to be leading this year. Information policy is, I think, going very, very strong. We've been working with assistance from a Gates grant on something called the Policy Revolution! And the goal on this is to refresh and to focus our messages so that we can create stronger link between our policy efforts and the impact that they have on society. So there's been a focus on employment, education, empowerment, and the goal being to create new messages that we can use in working with policymakers to help them understand that some of the issues that we're fighting for, let's say fair access, are not just academic matters or matters that are business matters, but that they really have an impact. As I said, we talked about e-government, for instance, as a way in which libraries deliver that. So I would say at this point that the information policy piece is going very strong. And again, I want to thank Gates for helping to give us a boost as we move forward on that. We're offering more and more workshops and sessions and webinars for members because we really need to do and want to do a much better job of helping people to explain how things like copyright actually impact their ability to do their day-to-day job and why it's important for us to advocate for them because it's in the interest of the people that we're trying to serve. Professional leadership development is the third of our strategic directions. We have a couple of things that we're working on this year. The first is that we are going to be launching our e-learning space, and that is a place where all of the continuing education, and there's quite a bit of it, as you probably have guessed, in ALA, will be easier to locate, easier to find, easier to register for, easier to share. One of the things that we have is that if you look at the broad range of education that's being offered through ALA, and we're talking about face-to-face conferences, we're talking about webinars, we're talking about publications, we're talking about subscriptions, that one of the things that we're working to bring together is to fit all the pieces of the puzzle together. And let me explain what I mean by that. We have, for instance, competences for librarianship. These translate into curricula. Those curricula translate into training programs. So part of what we're trying to do is to allow people to identify courses of study, to be able to maintain information so that they can acquire credentials, whether it's certifications or badges or other means of documenting their learning experiences. We also, at this point, are we're looking at those areas where education and training is absolutely essential. And let me give you an example of this. I call it the sort of Model T concept. There are probably 25 or 40,000 people that get hired each year to work in libraries. And one of the things that we would like to be able to offer is a very, very low-cost, basic online course that people can take in what are the basic issues in learning to work with people who have disabilities, for instance. And this is something that you can't just magically acquire and that it isn't something for individual libraries to try and put training together can be very difficult. So we're trying to look at areas. Intellectual freedom is another one. Some of these would be free. Some would be very, very low cost so that $25, so that we could then actually be able to offer training that really helps not just hundreds or even thousands of people, because we have thousands of people at this point who are involved in doing ALA training, but tens of thousands or really reaching everybody. I think the other area where we're very strong and continuing to develop is in things like you take Booklist, which 10 years ago was a print subscription. Now Booklist is really a multidimensional learning environment where people who are interested in literature or who are interested in reader's advisory can gather together and learn and find out what's creative, what's innovative, and that the pieces of the ALA puzzle, which is to say publishing, conferences and online learning, fit together more seamlessly.
Well, I want to wrap up with what I think is a softball question for you. basically talking up the ALA. So how do you frame the ALA in a way that convinces librarians to want to join, to want to renew, and want to become active in the organization? What do you tell librarians to get them excited about the organization?
Wow, no one's ever asked that before. No, I'm just teasing. I say that you have to invest in yourself. And if you look at the overall numbers, about half of the people in the field are ALA members. I would really argue, and this is based on my own experience, because I spent the first 5 years of my career not being a member, and I was really isolated. I would say that becoming a member makes the difference between a career and a job. And again, I know that there are many, many good people who, for whatever reason, have not joined. But joining the association provides you with an opportunity to learn, to network, to develop relationships that are going to sustain you for your whole career, that are going to keep you fresh and creative. I always say that ALA is not 60,000 people. It's the half dozen people that you're going to meet who share your particular brand of insanity. And that really is the case, that you come in and you say, oh, I never thought anyone else was interested in X or Y or Z. And there are just so many opportunities and so many interest groups within the association that you're hard-pressed to find something that there isn't an interest group around. And if you do find one, then I think you might as well just start an interest group. So part of it is it allows you to establish relationships with people that may be the next community over. They may be the other side of the country. In many instances now, increasingly, they're going to be international, so that you can learn, so that you have people that can help to feed your energy, that can help to keep you inspired, as we all face our day-to-day challenges. I also say that if you do go to a conference or an institute and you don't come back with three ideas that make you look absolutely brilliant, then you are spending too much time in the local bar. So it's impossible to go to a conference and not come back with brilliant ideas. And personally, I generally had to pay for part of my, always all of my membership, and usually about half of my conference attendance. It was the best investment that I ever made, because it made a difference for me in terms of my, you need something to inspire you, to challenge you. It's a rapidly changing field. It's the best way, I think, to tap into something that's going to sustain you going forward. And again, with more and more online opportunities, even if you can't fly across the country to go to San Francisco for a conference, there's plenty of ways in which you can participate and benefit from what is just the most fabulous network of amazing people, and that's the members.
Well, Keith, thank you so much for speaking to me today for the show. I think it was very educational for me, and I think it probably is for all the other listeners as well.
Steve, you're very, very kind. You're such a good host. I probably should be paying you. I appreciate your thoughtful questions. This has really been fun for me, and I hope it will be somewhat fun for others as well.
If people wanted to get in touch with you, do you have some contact information that they can?
Yeah, I'm at kfeels, K-F-I-E-L-S, at ala.org.
All right. Well, follow up with Keith if you have any other questions. So, Keith, thanks so much.
Okay, great. Thank you, Steve.
Yeah. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Circulating Ideas is produced by Steve Thomas in the suburbs of Atlanta. Music is by Pamela Klicka. If you'd like to listen to past episodes, read transcripts, or learn how you can help support the show, visit circulatingideas.com. You can follow the show on Twitter at CircIdeas or visit the show on Facebook at facebook.com/circulatingideas. Help others find the show by rating or reviewing the show on iTunes, Overcast, or your podcast app of choice. And keep circulating your ideas.